Russian Revolution, no less. The following year, it would be Reagan's turn to walk Red Square with Gorbachev. Politicians being politicians, at one point the Soviet leader took a little boy from his mother's arms and pointed him at the American president. "Shake hands with Grandpa," Gorbachev told the kid. When Gorbachev had been the boy's age, contact with a foreigner would have been a one-way ticket to the gulag. Now, to some extent, it was something to celebrate, not to fear. A clever reporter soon asked Reagan if he still regarded the USSR as an evil empire. "No," he confessed, "I was talking about another time, another era." Reagan was speaking the truth. 1 month later, Gorbachev took to the stage at the 19th All-Union Conference of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and delivered his opening speech, pointing out that the imposition of a social system, way of life, or policies from outside, by any means, let alone military, are dangerous trappings of the past period. Sovereignty and independence, equal rights and non-interference are becoming universally recognized rules of international relations, which is in itself a major achievement of the 20th century. To oppose freedom of choice is to come out against the objective tide of history itself. That is why power politics, in all their forms and manifestations, are historically obsolete. No one, not even Gorbachev himself, realized that in uttering those words, he had committed himself to freeing half the world. The rest was just application. Chapter 14, Because You Are Free. It started with Poland. White smoke rose from the Sistine Chapel's chimney on October 16, 1978 to signify that Karol Wojtyła, Archbishop of Krakow, had been selected as the new pope. The man who chose the regnal name of Pope John Paul II would be the first non-Italian pope since the Dutch Adrian VI held the papacy from 1952 to 53. As Polish historian Paweł Skibinski put it, it came as a shock to communists that it was possible to elect someone from the area they controlled without asking them for permission. The Western world, in turn, was shocked at the election of a person from behind the Iron Curtain, as it was generally known that a great majority of the region's inhabitants were controlled by communist authorities. Pope Paul VI had very much wanted to visit Poland in 1966 in order to mark the 1,000-year anniversary of Christianity coming to Poland, but he had been refused. This was the Polish People's Republic. There was no God here. Brezhnev tried to pass on a similar message to the new pope in 1969. "We know that Wojtyła is such a wise man," he said to Polish ruler Edward Gierek. "Tell him he must announce that he is sick. It will be better for him not to come to Poland." Pope John Paul made a pilgrimage to his homeland regardless and in perfectly good health. He delivered a series of several outdoor masses, with over 10 million Poles coming out over the course of his trip to join him in worship. On June 2nd, 1979, he stood in Victory Square, the largest city square in Warsaw, in front of a crowd of almost 300,000 citizens. The Pope offered a prayer for his home country and her people, concluding with a desperate plea. "I cry out from the depths of this millennium. Let your spirit descend and renew the face of the earth, the face of this land." The huge crowds who came out to see him over the course of his trip demonstrated to the Polish people that, despite years of communist occupation and propaganda, it was the faithful who were the true believers, who had the numbers, and not those who preached the doctrine of communism. The following July saw a round of labor strikes throughout Poland as workers protested a hike in prices without a corresponding increase in their wages. The state media did its best to suppress the news in hopes that each city would be left unaware of conditions elsewhere. But this was 1980, not 1940. It was far more difficult to suppress the flow of information and far easier to create underground newspapers and radio broadcasts. In this case, the strikers won. The Gdańsk Agreement of August 1980 reaffirmed the people's constitutional rights to freedom of speech and of the press. As importantly, it allowed for the establishment of a trade union not under the control of the ruling Polish United Workers' Party and guaranteed workers the right to strike. Partly inspired by the Pope's admonition to do what is right and to fight for the future of Poland, the newfound labor organization christened itself as Solidarity. As the nationwide movement continued to advocate for the workers, the Polish authorities began to more openly discuss the possibility of cracking down on dissent. By December of 1981, Solidarity was threatening a crippling general strike if any such measures were taken, and the Polish authorities called their bluff. They had little choice. They had been informed by Moscow in no uncertain terms that if they allowed the situation to spin out of control, then the Soviets would send in the tanks, just as they had done in Hungary in 1956 and in Czechoslovakia in 1968 and in Poland in 1939. Backing up the Soviet position was Erich Honecker, who prepared East German troops just in case. Poland was at the mercy of both Russian and German forces. It was World War II all over again. At 6 a.m. on December 13, 1981, the Polish government declared martial law and abandoned even the pretense of a country where law had any meaning. Hundreds of telecommunication exchanges were raided and telephone lines cut in order to prevent what they called misinformation from spreading. A nationwide curfew was imposed as huge swaths of industry were placed under military control. Airports airports were shut down, the borders sealed, and travel to and from major cities was heavily controlled. When coal miners in Wujek went on strike in protest, the government fired at them, killing 8 men. Other protests throughout Poland were met with similarly deadly consequences. The persecution worked. The protests died down, allowing martial law to finally be suspended a year later. Solidarity's leaders were given relatively short prison sentences, but the organization was officially banned. What had been a nationwide labor movement now became a heavily weakened underground resistance force. Thatcher visited Poland in November 1988, meeting with the same general Wojciech Jaruzelski who had imposed martial law 7 years prior. In the years since, however, the Polish leader had gradually toned down the authoritarianism and let Thatcher know that he wanted to open dialogue with Solidarity. Happy to act as an intermediary, she then went to visit their leader, Lech Walesa. She felt comfortable that she could help him get Jaruzelski to not just permit Solidarity to exist, but to grant it legal recognition. She urged Walesa to meet with Jaruzelski and exchange views to make sure the authorities heard what he was telling her. Walesa pointed at the ceiling. No problem, he told her. Our meetings are bugged anyway. The following month, Mikhail Gorbachev delivered a major speech to the United Nations. Reagan, and especially Thatcher, had consistently told the Soviet leader that a major reason why nuclear missiles were stationed in Western Europe was to serve as a counterweight to the USSR's enormous strength in conventional forces. Gorbachev could have used his troops as a bargaining chip, but instead he decided on another course to build trust with his rival powers and with the world at large. Within 2 years, the Soviet military would be reduced by half a million personnel, he announced. Rather than sending in the tanks, Gorbachev would be withdrawing them from East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, in addition to withdrawing tens of thousands of Soviet troops. He would also be cutting 10,000 tanks and hundreds of aircraft. It was a massive move toward a more peaceful world and a massive signal to the communist nations as to what kind of leader Gorbachev intended to be. Polish government officials were thus free to negotiate with Solidarity without the barrel of a Soviet gun to their backs. Even though still technically illegal, by this point Solidarity's support had grown very strong, with huge strikes causing massive disruption against the backdrop of a calamitous Polish economy. Jaruzelski knew that he needed to win over Solidarity or perhaps co-opt their ideas in order to maintain power. The party was not having it, yet they didn't have many options. We do not have a choice but to start these talks, Jaruzelski told them, pointing out that even martial law had not destroyed the Solidarity movement. Poland's Prime Minister Mieczysław Rakowski backed up the First Secretary. We are not dreaming about giving up power, he insisted. We are talking here about arranging to retain power. The Polish system being less centralized in the executive than the Soviet system was, it remained unclear whether the party votes for such a move were there. Jaruzelski decided to gamble it all, threatening to resign if he didn't get his way. The Prime Minister, Interior Minister, and Defense Minister all joined the First Secretary in his threat. The government was already losing its sense of legitimacy with the population, and a new leadership team, after close to a decade, would have an extraordinarily difficult time solving the crisis. Jaruzelski asked for, and won, a vote of confidence from the party in his leadership. The very next day, he announced that he would be engaging in official talks with Solidarity. For 2 months, the government met with Solidarity leaders and discussed every issue on hand. 92 total sessions of these roundtable talks ended up taking place, so-called due to the circular negotiation tables used to ensure that no one could be seen as sitting in a position of dominance at the head of the table. Shockingly, Solidarity was also given official access to the airwaves, where they could explain to the Polish people what was currently being negotiated that very day. It was instantly obvious that Solidarity's leaders were far more similar to the average Polish citizen than whatever caricature government propaganda had made of them during the preceding decade. In March of 1989, another nation followed Poland's lead. Thatcher had been correct in seeing Hungary as the most liberal of the communist nations. Now, Hungarian Prime Minister Miklós Németh paid a personal visit to Gorbachev in Moscow to let him know of a major decision, and tacitly to ask him for permission. 300 kilometers of barbed wire and electrified fencing separated Hungary from democratic Austria. Németh wanted to tear it all down, telling Gorbachev that it had outlived its usefulness. Hungary was not isolated from the outside world. Hungarians had been permitted to travel abroad, and the Hungarian capital of Budapest had become a tourist destination. The fence was not cheap and did little good, with fewer than a dozen Hungarians trying to annually cross it anyway. Gorbachev didn't bat an eye at the news, nor was he particularly upset at the Hungarian government's decision to open talks with oppositional forces, just as Poland had done. It seemed as if Gorbachev was tacitly disavowing the Brezhnev Doctrine. To be completely sure that he had permission to proceed, Németh reminded the Soviet leader that the USSR still had 80,000 troops stationed in Hungary. He didn't want a repeat of 1956. While Gorbachev said that he didn't agree with the multi-party system, either in principle or in Hungary specifically, you can be certain that there would be no instruction or order from us to crush it. He himself was allowing for very limited elections in the USSR for the Congress of People's Deputies. Though the system was rigged to guarantee a Communist Party victory, it still permitted the seating of several critical voices. That same day, Gorbachev met with Karl Gross, General Secretary of the Hungarian Socialist Workers' Party. The USSR had secretly had nuclear weapons in Hungary for years, and Gross wanted them gone. Gorbachev agreed. Gross decided to push his advantage. In order to distance us from the memories of 1956, I put it to you that all Soviet troops should leave Hungary. Gorbachev agreed as well, but had wanted to hold off to see if he could use the troop withdrawal as a bargaining chip to get NATO forces reduced in Europe as well. As a sign of good faith, hundreds of tanks and 5,000 Soviet troops were withdrawn from Hungary in short order. Gross was dumbfounded, and so was the East German leadership. Any border is only as strong as its weakest point. Removing the physical barrier between Hungary and the liberal democracy of Austria was a major breach in the Iron Curtain. Worse, none of the other Warsaw Pact members had been consulted about this decision. To add insult to injury, the Soviet leadership was fine both with the idea and with how it had been decided. The East Germans phoned the Hungarian leadership and were assured that East Germans would not be permitted to use Hungary as a pit stop to fleeing to the West. Days later, massive demonstrations took place in Budapest. One dissident leader stood in front of the parliament building and proclaimed to the crowd that history has pronounced its death sentence on the system called socialism. Instead of incarceration, his only consequence was massive applause from the people. Nor was Hungary alone. On March 26, 1989, another nation followed Poland's lead, the Soviet Union itself. Understanding that the Soviet bureaucracy could often serve as an impediment to his perestroika agenda, Gorbachev invoked Lenin's slogan of all power to the Soviets and called for a limited election to replace the Supreme Soviet with a more pluralistic communist legislature. Getting one's name on the ballot was an extraordinarily difficult process, but for those who persevered, the results paralleled Poland's. As Dobbs wrote, when the election returns came in, the apparatchiks received a huge shock. In most places where there was a clear choice, the party-approved candidate was defeated. The list of the vanquished read like a who's who of Soviet public life. Politburo members, generals, cosmonauts, government ministers, and the mayors or party bosses of Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, Minsk, and many other big cities. The final details of Poland's roundtable talks were agreed to 2 weeks after that. Solidarity would be legalized and given official recognition. One third of the seats in the lower house of Congress and all 100 seats in the Senate would now be democratically contested. The Polish government saw this not as a loss of power, but as a way of integrating the opposition into the state and validating its authority. It was regarded as a 10 to 15 year process toward a stable power sharing arrangement. But these hopeful trends were not the same throughout the Warsaw Pact. Romania especially veered in a different direction. Communism in practice often result in the elevation of the mediocre to the highest levels of power, and there are few better examples of this than Romanian leader Nicolae Ceaușescu. One glance at the man whose bottom lip always stuck out called to mind those unfortunate people that can be seen wandering around at airports who cannot help the fact that they were born fucked up. In a free country, Ceaușescu would have been a mailroom clerk, baffled if a written address was mismatched between 757 Legion Street and 757 Legion Avenue. The Czechs had just such an anecdote about one of their communist rulers. President Antonín Novotný released his fury on a maintenance man who was taking a long time to repair an ordinary door lock. He told the worker that he could have done it himself in no time. The maintenance man's response could not have been any truer for the time. "Well, yes, Mr. President, because you are a locksmith, but I'm a university professor." One of Ceaușescu's youthful comrades described him as completely uninteresting and always pretending to be more important than he really was. He recalled that the young Ceaușescu was afflicted with a risible stammer, which was so bad that people avoided him. They didn't want to laugh in his face. His stammering spasms were sometimes so violent that his leg would twitch uncontrollably to the rhythm of the stammer, and this got on people's nerves. He was a youngster whom everyone despised. As Ceaușescu grew older, his biggest skill was knowing how to work the system, which made him the right man at the right time to replace Romanian leader Gheorghe Gorgudej when he died of cancer in 1965. No one particularly liked Ceaușescu, but no one particularly hated him either. He was the perfectly acceptable compromise candidate. When Ceaușescu took over Romania, he did so as an unorthodox communist leader. In 1968, for example, he very publicly denounced the Soviet Union's invasion of Czechoslovakia, and he often did not follow Moscow's lead in other matters. On the other hand, Ceaușescu implemented Decree 770 in 1967, which was aimed at increasing Romania's population by 50%. Proclaiming that the fetus is the property of the entire society, both abortion and contraception were made illegal for women under the age of 40 or with fewer than 4 children. Childlessness was taxed and the marriage age lowered to 15. Romanian women of childbearing age were given mandatory gynecological exams every month under the supervision of the so-called menstrual police. A miscarriage would result in questioning by the authorities, where the traumatized woman would be forced to prove that she had in fact lost her baby organically. Ceausescu visited both China and North Korea in 1971 and became heavily inspired by the Stalinist personality cults developed there by Chairman Mao and the great leader Kim Il-sung, respectively. Soon, Romanians were constantly told about his unparalleled brilliance and leadership skills. Part of the ensuing propaganda was expanded to include his wife Elena, whose utterly non-existent beauty was praised in unfettered terms just as highly as her utterly non-existent intelligence was. As historian Edward Baer pointed out, as conditions inside Romania worsened, Romanians not only had to endure new privations, but also had to praise those responsible for inflicting them in increasingly fulsome terms. After dropping out of school at age 14, Elena had been expelled from the Bucharest Municipal Adult Education Institute night school courses for cheating on a test. Nevertheless, as First Lady of Romania, she received a fraudulent PhD in chemistry in 1967. Her scientific ignorance was painfully clear to her subordinates when she was appointed director of Bucharest Institute of Chemistry. Funding requests for ethyl alcohol would be denied by her out of concerns that the researchers wanted to, in her words, make their own home brew. The researchers then simply asked for C2H6O funding, the chemical formula for ethyl alcohol, which was thereupon granted. Ghostwritten scientific papers were presented as having been written by the barely educated woman, and the Romanian government lobbied international publications and organizations to publish her work and grant her honorary degrees. The state media could then reasonably speak of Elena as being a world-renowned scientist. Despite all this, Elena never treated her subordinates with any sense of gratitude for the work that they did on her behalf. On the contrary, Romanian Health Minister Eugen Proca regarded her as very vain and almost illiterate, as well as unadulterated evil. Ceausescu sought to triangulate Romania between the USSR and the West in order to receive favors from both, and his efforts met with a great amount of success. As the 1970s proceeded, Romania's economy became industrialized via heavy loans from Western governments. Despite turning Romania into the most authoritarian of the Soviet bloc nations, Ceausescu's posturing against the USSR allowed him entree into Western circles that were eager to exploit differences within the communist Second World. Nikolai and Elena waved from the White House balcony as the guests of both Presidents Nixon and Carter and danced with President Ford in the streets of Bucharest. The Ceausescu's antics naturally continued abroad. On one official visit to the United States, for example, for some reason, Elena insisted that all their menus be written out in French, despite the fact that neither of them spoke it. In 1978, Queen Elizabeth II gave Nikolai the royal welcome in London by making him a Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath, her highest award for a foreign leader. On the other hand, as Gorbachev later wrote, Ceausescu was not particularly welcome in Moscow. He was not forgiven for his ambitions and his demonstrative flirtations with the West. As leader, Ceausescu undertook a plan he called systemization, which sought to abolish the line between urban life and rural life by a massive process of destruction and reconstruction. In the countryside, village householders were given short notice to evacuate their homes, which were then bulldozed. They were rehoused in concrete boxes, often with communal kitchens, toilets, and washing facilities. Some 500 villages were razed in this way, and thousands more were due for demolition. The aim was to do away with archaic village life and get rid of the difference between factory and agricultural workers. Needless to say, cooped up in apartment blocks, people were far easier to keep under surveillance than had they continued living in individual houses. As a result of production bottlenecks, cheap materials, inadequate budgets, and corruption, the new village suburbs were abysmally built, often with no plumbing or running water. In these new Ceausescu complexes, it was impossible to keep rabbits, chickens, ducks, or geese, which would have been a small mainstay for many Romanians as the food situation steadily deteriorated. As the 1980s rolled around, those international loans to Romania came due. Just as Stalin had done during his assault on the kulaks, Ceausescu focused on exports at the expense of his population. For the Romanian citizenry, the prices for goods and services increased dramatically as cuts were made in government spending on housing, healthcare, and education. Food was strictly rationed. Television broadcasting was limited to 3 hours a day, with many neighborhoods not having enough electricity for even that. Baer noted the consequences of the sudden power cuts that forced coal miners to climb up ladders in the dark at the end of their shifts or compelled surgeons to abort surgical operations at the last moment. This was in addition to infants whose life support machines were suddenly disconnected or the patients whose iron lungs suddenly stopped. The combination of Romania's poverty with the forced increase in birth rate resulted in disastrous consequences. Mortality rates among pregnant women and infants set European records. An entire generation was raised by government orphanages dedicated to children whose parents parents simply could not afford to feed them and who were encouraged to abandon them to the superior wisdom of state experts. The Romanian government could not afford to raise them well either, resulting in years of room upon room of infants chained to their cribs in puddles of their own waste to little or no caretaker response. Malnutrition, which resulted in stunted growth and mental disabilities, was the norm, with both physical and sexual assault against the children not uncommon. AIDS spread